Dear friends, old and new, history is a series of little stories, or so at least Herodotus, the father of history, thought. And so, here are some little stories, entertaining or otherwise. Lissy Voglin once said that she could not hire someone to help her with the cleaning, for when the Putzfrau switched on the vacuum, Erich Voglin would emerge from his study in his bathrobe and in a tone of wounded and confused majesty inquire, "What? Today?" Ah, the power of that Anglo-Saxon four-letter word, what? 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 Today? Yes, friends, today. I grew up in an Illinois town in which traditionally the priest came from Germany or was educated in Germany. When I was in grade school, the pastor was a man ill-suited to his task. In those Depression years, he permitted the parish to sink into chaos and ruin, and was said to have loved men and boys a little too much. At last, a committee from the parish went to the bishop and asked that he be removed. The bishop, like the trustees of Hillsdale College, refused, saying that the committee had only hearsay evidence and that he could not act. However, after a few years, that great Christian worker, Death, did what the bishop had refused to do, and the parish got a new priest. He too was a German, a refugee from National Socialism, and a man who devoted the whole of his lifetime, he died at age 93 recently, to the people of his parish. He was a descendant of a prominent Bad Godesberg family that had been influential in the foundation of the Catholic Center Party. And he was an intellectual who wore his learning with grace and ease. The farmers and the small town people of his parish didn't know what to make of him. For a while, his sermons were intellectual and theological exercises, which stunned his parishioners into amused silence. Finally, one of the parishioners came to him and said, "Father, your sermons are, as Germans say, too high for us. Just tell us a little story." A little story. What? Today? In 1954, the conservative movement was hardly more than a handful of people, a self-selected elite who knew something was terribly wrong with the politics, the economics, and the community life of the American Republic. Though they were not political physicians, they could hear the death rattle of the left liberal old order. They set about to educate themselves, to argue, to discuss, organize, and especially to recruit. The older statesmen, the elder statesmen, none of them very old, were uniformly concerned with the recruitment of the next generation of the movement. This elite, many of whom were distinguished communists, disillusioned by what was happening, or fellow travelers, knew from firsthand experience the power both of ideas and of organization. It was this consciousness of standing on the forefront of history of battling at Marathon and Thermopylae, which gave the elite its special quality and its dynamic force. Many, like Whitaker Chambers, felt that the battle had already been lost. It was reported to me by someone who ought to have known that Henry Kissinger believed that the tides of history would carry Soviet power to the fore, and that his role was simply to buy time. Not everyone was so gloomy, to be sure. Aside from the Soviet threat and the fact of internal subversion, the conservative elite spent its time battling the growth of centralization of state power and restoring order and meaning to everyday life. In this respect, the first generation of the conservative elite distinguished themselves from those who came to call themselves neoconservatives, who were, in fact, anti-communist statists. Moreover, the first generation of the conservative elite participated in the religious revival of the 1950s and 60s. Those who discovered the religious right in the second half of the decade of the 90s are just about half a century too late. The essential character of that primal conservative elite was religious and value-oriented. And if conservatism has anything to say at the beginning of the new millennium, it will embody the beliefs and the values of that earlier elite. We are now more aware than ever that man does not live by bread alone. Many in those early days of the movement liked to think of themselves as individualists. And indeed, there once was a society which called itself the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, Incorporated. I always took that to mean that its members distinguished themselves from the schools of bottom-feeding liberals who dominated every campus, every faculty, and who automatically assumed that unless one took one's politics from the New Republic and the Nation, one's aesthetics from the Partisan Review, and one's entertainment from the New Yorker, one was intellectually unqualified to serve on a college or university faculty. Indeed, these individualists paid dearly for the views they held and the ideas they defended. The danger to the conservative elite in our time, and this has been happening for some time, however, was not the stranglehold of the left liberal elite on education and society, the academy. The great danger to the conservative elite was rather the success which that elite generated in the social, political, and economic world. Conservatism was simply too successful. Once the conservative intellectual elite entered the realm of power, that intellectual surrendered himself and his motives to that power and its amassment through politics and bureaucracy. At that point, he traded in his tweed coat for the pinstripe suit, caught Potomac fever, and went off to Washington to become a denizen of a think tank. The moral of this little story is that if the conservative movement is to be successful in the years ahead, it must cease to be dominated by policy wonks, and it must find a form of creativity other than writing position papers. The Weberian transition from the realm of ideas to the realm of power has very important consequences for the conservative movement, and these must be recognized and dealt with. The conservative elite of 40 years ago was not simply a happy band which suddenly found itself to be thinking forbidden thoughts and debating undiscussable propositions. The existence of this happy band was the consequence of deliberate recruitment. There was a handful of creative leaders who said, in effect, "Come, follow me." Men such as Frank Meyer, Richard Weaver, Ludwig von Mises, Kenneth Templeton, Russell Kirk, M. Stanton Evans, Henry Regnery, Don Lipset, to name only a few, made it their business to identify talent, to recruit graduate students, to organize meetings, and to see that there was a next generation. They were intellectually diverse and with personalities as large and contradictory as the issues with which they engaged. It has struck me increasingly that their like has disappeared from the conservative movement, and that converts are made, if at all, from the printed page or from the internet. This does not bode well for the future of conservatism. Every great transforming movement in the history of the world is essentially a movement of the spoken word. Jesus and Socrates did not write books. Books, indeed, are important, but they are afterthoughts. There must always be an original kerygma or proclamation. It may be Frank Meyer calling at 2 a.m. in the morning from Woodstock, or Kenneth Templeton sitting in the living room when the morning stars sang together and the fireplace fire had gone out, or students at an ISI summer school talking, not only talking, but arguing far into the night. When the kerygma ceases and the movement bureaucrats take over, the vitality of the movement is threatened. Moreover, the early conservative movement was a community. Frank Meyer, who had been a communist organizer in the Midwest, once remarked to me that the communist movement, like the early Christian movement, was a movement in which no one was a stranger. One could come into a strange town and find immediately hospitality and companionship. And so it was with the early conservative movement. There was a kind of hospitality, a bond of hospitality and friendship. I find this intense spirit of community lacking in today's conservative movement, and I wonder whether it is not another harbinger of the sclerotic in the movement. A room full of 500 people eating rubber chicken is no substitute for a night at Macosta or Woodstock or Three Oaks. Finally, I wish to say a few words about the importance of the truth to the conservative movement. For conservatism developed essentially as a response to persistent and massive left liberal untruth. The problem was not simply Lillian Hellman, who, it was observed, never wrote a truthful word in her life. Even the these and the ands were a lie. Franklin Roosevelt was nearly equally incapable of the truth. He was the leader of the pack, and many in it were more mendacious and artful than he was. Conservatism sought to banish the right to lie. The right to lie in the name of reason of state, Staatsraison, raison d'etat. There is no greater enemy to community than the lie. It dissolves common purposes and mutual confidence. How terrible then that conservatism in power succumbed to lying. I do not mean the lazy dummies among conservative writers who resorted in a pinch to plagiarism. I've known a number of them. I don't think it profitable to give the infamous fame by naming them. In 1974, I attended a meeting in West Branch, Iowa, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of President Herbert Hoover. The conference divided its time between the celebration of a noble and tragic figure in American history and the slow motion televised abdication of a pseudo-conservative liar, President Nixon. In the person of William Jefferson Clinton, we have seen how low the presidency can sink. Not only has the president behaved in a loathsome fashion, but he has lied more persistently than any other figure in American history, including Mike Fink. Here, I shall not speak of those supposed conservatives, the Ravelsteins, who have practiced an intellectual dissimulation which permitted them to say, in the secret writing in which they indulged, one thing and intend another. No Athenian sophist was more adroit. Nor shall I dwell at length on the subject of a college president who did enormous harm, not only to the institution he guided, but to the conservative causes he supposedly espoused. There have also been those men who saw conservatism as a way to personal status and power, men devoid of any purpose other than, as one of my students observed, an ego splat. I knew one of these dark men from the gutter. I knew him quite well. He lied to himself. He lied to his friends. He created a fictitious past for himself. And he even lied in creating objects for his inordinate hatreds. He lied as to his purposes and beliefs, and he harmed the movement and those in any way connected with him. Bill Buckley, with charity not unlike that of my wife, who believes that serial murderers are victims of a bad breakfast, observes that as Christians, we must all recognize our fallen state and draw a veil of forgiveness over dark and unseemly deeds. This is nonsense, and Mr. Buckley knows it. Yes, we forgive the sinner, but it is equally important that we recognize that sinner and sinned against must live out the temporal consequences due to sin. The disruption of the social order and the natural order that sin produces. The road to recovery is an acknowledgement and quest for remedies for those actions which are matters to be dealt with in the exterior forum. And now, having told these little stories, like the wise king advising his minions as he sends them off on heroic deeds. Let me say, be good, be smart, be brave.